I'm Christopher Lydon with the biographer of a painting, Erika Hirschler, in hope of solving a few of the mysteries around an American masterpiece that's on the wall in front of us. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. The painting in question is John Singer Sargent's grand square canvas of the Daughters of Edward Darley Boyd. You remember those four girls in the very picture of polite privilege. Four sisters, ages 4, 8, 12, and 14, alongside giant blue and white Japanese vases in their Paris apartment in 1881. I think it's fair to say, Erika, that in our lifetimes, this is Boston's favorite painting by Boston's favorite painter. But what does that tell you? What should that tell us?
The painting means a lot to people in a lot of places. Bostonians feel a special attachment to it because it's been at the Museum of Fine Arts since 1912. And there are local ties with both Sargent and with the Boyd family. But I've discovered in the course of my work that people all over the world are attracted to the mystery and glamour, really, of this picture.
I remember it as a child, and you probably do. I thought it was a painting done in Boston on Commonwealth Avenue at the corner of Berkeley Street. I associate it with Eleanora Sears, but I associate it with all those gorgeous girls that were maybe inaccessible, you know?
A lot of people think it was done in Boston, and it comes as a great surprise to many people that it was actually painted in Paris, and that both the Boyds and Sargent were happily living in Paris in the early 1880s. And in fact, Sargent had never even been to Boston at the time that this picture was made. I think it attracts people because it's not so easy to understand. It's not straightforward. It is mysterious. You can only see two of the girls clearly, and the other two fade into the background. One even turns away from us. And that's an unusual thing to see in a portrait. It's not even clear whether it was meant to be a portrait or even whether the Boyds commissioned it.
Can I suggest it's not a portrait? It's an interior, it's a social statement, it may be a kind of history of girlhood in four stages. It's also about their pinafores, it's also about privilege and wealth and beauty, and it's also lurking somewhere about the mystery of what happened to these women.
Well, the Hirschler version of what's going on here is all of those things and also something else important that I think sometimes gets left out as we seek to understand the biographies of these girls, what became of them afterwards. And the part that often I feel gets left out is the art part. Sargent, as an ambitious young painter, seeking to make an artistic statement that was unusual for its day, and that really treads the boundaries between what was acceptable as a portrait and what was expected in an interior. It is on the tightrope between one and the other. It's on the tightrope between looking back to the old masters and looking ahead towards the kinds of modern interiors with groups of unrelated figures by artists like Degas. While it speaks to the lives of these girls, it also is vague enough and general enough to speak to us. It's not captured in its time the way a lot of period things are.
Erika, you remind me, in your book, the most fascinating single thing, single number, surely, is his age. He was 26 years old when he painted this. And as you say, he was on the make. He had an annual entry in the Paris Salon show. He was making a reputation. He did it many ways, including the famous scandalous Madame X. But this was his entry for the year 1883. What did he think he was doing?
I think he really was thinking about issues of public display. The first thing that tells you that is the size of the picture. It's attention-grabbingly big. It's also square, which makes you focus more on the surface arrangement of the objects in that space. It doesn't lead your eye back. It doesn't lead your eye from side to side. It does both at the same time. I think he was also showing off in a way. It's incredible how he differentiates all the different whites in the picture. How those pinafores look different when the light shining upon them is different, whether the white is in bright light as it is in the foreground or in shadow as it is in the background, how it glimmers off of those smooth china surfaces of the Japanese faces, and how white becomes the reflection in the mirror over the fireplace in the background. There are all these different colors of white that are really one of an artist's ways of showing off.
You know, the knock on Sargent over many years has included the line that he painted appearances without analysis. Some have said bluntly that he painted a society without a soul, or certainly that he painted a pseudo-aristocracy without staying power, which may be true, actually. But consider this question of what he is reading in these girls. I mean, it seems to me it's easy to make an argument now that he had great depth of emotional understanding and statement here about each one of those faces.
I think Sargent isn't given as much credit as he deserves for his ability to see. And that comes through in the remarkable dexterity with which he applied paint to canvas and his ability to capture, without seemingly any effort, the shapes and looks of things. But I think it also applies very much to his ability to see people and to catch brief expressions on their faces, or a sense of boredom in posing, or even in some portraits, a sense of antagonism between the sitter and the painter.
Erica Herschler, would you take those four girls in order? On the left, Mary Louisa, Isa, as she was known, then Flore, the eldest, then Jeannie, maybe the most troubled in their whole life, and the child, Julia, the most open, the most available, and the nearest to us as we look. Tell us about them, what you see as of 1881, 82, and then their lives.
Well, Isa, who stands on the left, looks to me like a little ballerina. She's got one foot forward as if she were in a ballet position, and her arms beautifully held behind her back.
She's a little like that Degas child.
She's a little like that Degas dancer, only wearing play clothes, really. All the girls are wearing play clothes. They're not wearing their best silks and satins and white stockings and the things that they would have worn had they been dressed to go out or go to a party. Instead, they're wearing play clothes or clothes that they would have worn in the schoolroom. It's a casual look.
What's to say about that look on her face that says, I'm watching you, I'm doing what you require, but don't get too close? There's a certain reserve.
There's very much a reserve to Isa, I think. She is stepping forward but sort of pulling back at the same time. And she's in pretty bright light, but at the same moment, she is half in shadows. You do have a sense that she's got things on her mind that aren't being shared with us.
Every one of these girls played an instrument. She played the harp. Remind us, though, what happened in her life.
Well, Isa lived with her younger sister, Julia, for her entire life. What is often a surprise is that none of these girls ever married, although in studying society in the late 19th century, particularly Boston society, it's not as unusual an event as people want to make it out to be. Julia and Isa lived together in Paris, in Italy, and later in Boston, and she kept music very much in her life until she died in her 80s in Newport.
Flore, the eldest, her back to that vase, was an athlete, lived in a Boston marriage, and you can explain what that is all about, but was a great golfer, helped bring golf to the country club in Brookline, Massachusetts. She's half lit in a profile, so doubly half seen. What about Florrie?
I think Florrie is really the most independent and free-spirited of the girls because her father was such a vivacious and interesting personality. They traveled constantly. They went back and forth across the Atlantic almost as if they were the frequent flyers of their day. And Florrie became quite a sportswoman. Both her father and Florrie played golf. She was dedicated to the sport, and when she came to visit her aunt and uncle who lived in Wellesley, Massachusetts, legend has it she set up a course on the lawn of the Honeywell's house in Wellesley by sinking flower pots into the garden.
Florrie was a violinist. Jeannie, standing next to her, sort of looking a little blankly into the middle distance, was an almost compulsive pianist, it turns out, but a troubled person. Introduce Jeannie.
Jeannie is, I think, the saddest character in the group. She was the second daughter. She did have some sort of mental problems, whether it was an obsessive-compulsive disorder or something. When she played the piano, she played it compulsively and didn't eat her meals and was difficult to drag away from her pursuits.
Julia, known as Yaya, sitting on the floor on a beautiful Chinese rug with a doll between her legs, is the youngest and the most available in a certain sense, the most relaxed, the most calm, the most serene looking at the painter. She was also the cellist in the family. What happened to Julia?
Well, I love the ideas of these four girls doing concerts before their parents' dinner parties, which of course they did. And Julia, who had quite a knack for drawing, often made illustrated programs for the concerts describing what each of the girls was going to play. Julia was vivacious, lively. She had a great sense of humor, according to people who knew her. And she was very adept as a watercolor painter. And she really captured the different places and spaces in which these girls live their lives.
There's an abundance of story in this painting. Is it too much to say that John Singer Sargent kind of not read the future, but saw the depths of what was unfolding here, even as he painted them in 1882?
I think Sargent does pick up nuances of people's personalities, and I think you can postulate that Julia, the youngest, who sits so accessibly on the floor, really almost in our space, might turn out to be the most lively and friendly of the group. But at the same time, I sort of resist the idea of looking at a picture of a girl at age four and using it to predict her entire life story.
Let me try it a different way. I associate Sargent with his friend Henry James, whom he painted a number of times. And I associate this painting in a different way with that Venice interior with four, again, Boston figures in a family scene. It's not that they tell a story or that you could caption it in any simple way, much less that he's foretelling the lives of these girls, but he is filling that space with a certain social and emotional electricity. There's something going on here.
I think that's one of the brilliancies of this picture, which is that it does speak to many stories, to many different people, and tells different stories over time. One of the things I was fascinated with is that our pretty automatic response to analyze the picture and to try and sort out the psychological states of these girls is something that nobody really did until the 1970s. And that before the age of psychology, if you want to put it that way, people really took it in much more artistic terms and didn't try to understand whether there was whether there was sibling rivalry or some kind of mysterious relationship.
Is that right?
The girls. It's fascinating, but the psychology is really speaking as much to our own age and our own needs as it speaks to whatever Sargent saw in this family.
Remind us of that way up, way down graph of Sargent's reputation and people's feeling about what this sort of painting meant.
I think it's fascinating how this work has lived over time and been interpreted over time. I mean, when it was first painted, it really was the art part that people found so unsettling, I guess, because of the way it really is a painting about modern life in a modern interior. Girls not dressed for show, but really in their everyday moments. And that was a very new kind of painting in Sargent's day. At the same time, it reflected back to the old masters and therefore couldn't be dismissed the way a lot of the Impressionists were dismissed for being too crazy, too modern. But Sargent's fortunes really changed with the advent of modernism, and especially in the late teens and 1920s. And Sargent was held to be the bastion of old-fashioned art. Whatever modern tendencies he had in his own work weren't seen at all by modernist critics, who really only saw him as a recorder of upper class society and of the surfaces of things rather than the souls of things. And Sargent's reputation as a painter plummeted after his death. He really is revived in the 1970s and 80s with the wholesale rediscovery, really, of American art that takes off, I would say, in 1976 with the American Bicentennial. But it takes longer for artists like Sargent, Cassatt, Whistler, the ones who didn't work in the United States and who don't speak as much to those sort of bedrock American values like Homer or Aikens are seen to have done. And so his reputation takes a little bit longer to come back. He is flying high now, Sargent.
Can I presume to say, I feel I've sort of lived through the Sargent ups and downs. When I was a boy in Boston, he was still revered. He was a bulwark against modernism. I think the great love of Sargent around Boston delayed the arrival of a modern sensibility, even in this museum in a way, for maybe 50 years. But all that is behind us now. I'm wondering, really, is it okay for people like me whose parents loved him, who rejected him as old fogyish, is it okay for us to love him again?
I think it is, and I think the story is never as black and white as it appears when the controversies are taking place. Well, one of the things that I find most attractive and appealing and immediate about Sargent's work is his handling of paint, which is something that many people who appreciate modern art, which is all about gesture and stroke and the application of paint, look at. And to look carefully at those white pinafores and see these amazingly energetic, quick, thick stabs of paint that make them up is really to have a good sense of the artist at work, which is something that I think is very appealing to us today.
So I turned to a working artist and teacher, Robert Bart, an abstractionist himself, standing before the same Sargent painting, and ask him to spell out what a painter sees in all that application of paint.
The paint would be on his palette, he would be doing some mixing there, and he would bring it over to the canvas, and he'd lay some down and make a decision about whether it was in the right spot or not. And you can't do that the first time through. And when that paint goes on, it really does, it hits the surface, and in his case, he'll take that gob of paint after he's maybe done a preliminary setup of the area, and then go in and drop in a color for a highlight, a scrape here and there. And there's a lot of things, like I see some dry brush on the on the side of this apron over here. This is an unusual brush stroke. It's something that's done on another surface of wet paint or tacky paint, and it really has a transparency and a quick heat that you don't do that move twice unless you start all over. So there's things that he does, and he may have scraped off. There's areas of palette knife application, especially in this piece here. These flat areas here are not done with a brush. They're done with a palette knife. That's done with a brush because you can see the brush hairs or the way the brush hairs separated. But there's a lot of things here. He may have even put paint on with his fingers. Many artists did that. But that physical, that juiciness of paint, that a la prima process is so, there's great pleasure in doing it that way, but it's extremely difficult to accomplish. And a lot of this kind of stuff, really, to me, that's why I think of de Kooning and I think of other, Richard Diebenkorn. He was really painterly in his early period of painting. He's a California artist, was contemporary with the abstract expressionists, very well known, but didn't get the attention that Klein and de Kooning and Pollock did. But you see all of this brushwork showing up in later work. This is very contemporary kind of expressionistic brushwork that Hals did it. Frans Hals, Dutch painter, 17th century. Beautiful, rich brushwork and very juicy paint, but you don't see that too often. So this kind of, to me, a real step forward, and it's really beautiful to look at. You know, that's why I can appreciate paint on canvas without, you know, any kind of reference to imagery.
The first time I saw this painting, I was in college, and I came to the MFA, as a good art history major does, and I was very taken with it because it reminded me of myself growing up. Here are all these little blonde girls and with their hair pulled back, and they reminded me of me when I was a little girl. I was also sort of struck by the fact that I wasn't so much older than Florrie when I first saw it, the oldest girl, but I wasn't so much younger than Sargent either. Florrie was 14, Sargent was 26. It's not the biggest gap in age in the world. I was in my early 20s. And then the picture has retained this fondness for me that began when I first began to work at the Museum of Fine Arts. I was working for Trevor Fairbrother, who did a remarkable exhibition in the 1980s called The Bostonians, Paintings of an Elegant Age. And at that time, we borrowed the big vases for the first time. They still belonged to the family at that point. And I was a young intern, anxious and willing to do anything that I was asked to do, and somebody thought it would be fun if I put on a pinafore and leaned against one of the vases. And I did it, and so all of a sudden the painting took on this very visceral, personal quality for me. I knew what it felt like to be Florrie, leaning, and I can say, uncomfortably back against that big vase. What I really found was, again, the art part, thinking about how difficult it must have been to pose. I didn't see it as a predatory thing, but as a sort of slave to art thing, that one made sacrifices in order to allow the artist his vision. And what fascinated me is it was never finished. There was always another page to the book, always another leaf to explore, or a petal to try and examine.
For what it's worth, I think I saw this painting probably first when I was maybe 6 or 8 or 10. From the Irish other side of the tracks, this was an absolute distillation of Boston privilege to which we both aspired and also felt kind of wary of. I thought it was a Boston scene. I thought the girls were utterly exquisite and maybe halfway inviting. But then over many, many years, I sort of lost confidence in Sargent, regained it. One of the last times I really looked hard at this was at the Metropolitan Museum in New York, maybe 5, 6, 8 years ago, in a Velázquez show. And I thought, my God, this stands up brilliantly in the toughest all-time competition there is for a painting. I also have read a lot of Henry James in the meantime, and I see I see this storytelling mastery in an ambiguous but open way to the excitement, the possibility, the dangers, the risks of just life. And I love it more than ever.
I love it more than ever, too, because it doesn't answer questions, it asks them.
Amen.
What I love is that it continues to capture attention of writers and poets. I've just been sent a novel about it, which I am about to read. There are plays and musicals about it. Everybody responds to it in a different way, but they can't help but respond to it, which I think is really the mark of a masterpiece.
Thank you, Erica Hirschler. This is such a pleasure to hear you on it, and it's been a joy to read your book, Sargent's Daughters. Thank you. Thank you for your work. Thank you for this conversation.
You're very welcome. It's my great pleasure.
Ben Mandelkern and Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Erica Hirschler of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. Her book is Sargent's Daughters, The Biography of a Painting. Special thanks to Robert Bart for a contemporary painter's appreciation of John Singer Sargent. And because beauty is ever in the eye of the beholder, add your own angle on the daughters of Edward Darley Boyd in a comment on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.